We have a busy day ahead of us here on Issues Etc. We're going to spend the first half hour of the program talking with astronaut Sandra Magnus. She'll be joining us to talk about her reaction to the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy. And there is news out as well today, this morning, some good news in that unfolding investigation that something akin to the flight data recorder was recovered. And there's still a question mark as to what they will be able to discover there. Without speculating as to the cause of the tragedy, we will be talking with Sandra Magnus about that for the first half hour. And then we're going to be talking with Amy White. She has written a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Today's column is titled, At One with the Shepherd. It is about the recent death of a St. Louis pastor, Rodney Stortz, known to most of us probably because he spoke at Jack Buck's memorial and funeral. But we'll be talking about his contribution to the St. Louis area, in particular, not only the lease on life that he got as a victim of cancer, but also his clear proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ at any and every public opportunity he had. That's Amy White in the second part of the program. We'll round off the first hour talking with Bill Beckman, Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life, about abortion legislation in the Illinois House and Senate. The second hour of the program we'll spend with Pastor Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll talk about pietism during that hour. What is it? We'll find out then. And then the last hour of the program we'll spend with Dr. Jack Preuss. He served as a military chaplain during the first Gulf War, attached to a company of Marines in Saudi Arabia. We'll talk about ministry to soldiers in the third hour of Issues, Etc. I do want to spend a few minutes here before we talk with Sandra Magnus talking about the war, because it has finally begun. It has not begun the way we thought it would. I sat at the edge of my bed this morning. I waited to turn on the television until about 10 o'clock because I thought, well, nothing's going to happen until the sun goes down in Iraq. And I was anxious to see what was going on in Baghdad, and I was not disappointed. They had the cameras trained in every which direction there in that city. Sun had gone down. Looks like an ordinary city. Every once in a while you hear a few tap, tap, tap. Maybe you'd hear a boom. I was wanting more. Sat there on the edge of my bed feeling a little disappointed that I wasn't watching similar coverage to the first Gulf War, where, of course, the sky was lit and tracers from the anti-aircraft weapons were streaking through the sky, and it was really something to see. And then I started listening to the reporters, and I noticed they were disappointed too. And in observing their disappointment, I started to think to myself, what are you looking for, Wilkin? What do you want? I mean, do you want to see massive bombs blowing up over this city? Why do you want to see that? Beyond just sheer purient interest, sheer voyeurism, viewing war as a spectator sport. Now, it's very easy, folks, for us to cross the line. I am a supporter of the war. I've made no bones about that. But it's very easy for us to cross the line of patriotism, support for the war, support for the troops, which everyone shares, as far as I can tell, and a desire to see the war executed in a proper, lawful, and successful fashion. It's very easy to cross over from all of those sentiments into bloodthirstiness, or taking the violence of war, the tragedy, and, to put it quite frankly, the evil of war, as though we were sitting down to watch the Salukis play Mizzou. That's not what war is about. People are dying. And it's not only a bad thing when our people die in executing a war, it's also a bad thing when our enemies die. Do we have a wicked enemy over there in Baghdad? There's no doubt about that. Would the world be better off on the whole without a Saddam Hussein to threaten the rest of us? Yes. But God says, I do not take pleasure in the death of the wicked. If he doesn't take pleasure in it, neither should we. We can root for the troops, but I don't think we should be rooting for the bombs to drop in rain-like fashion over that city. They may have to, but we should be viewing it exactly the way our God views the death of the wicked. He takes no pleasure in it. You know, to sit there and root for bigger explosions and bigger flashes of light And I'm speaking first and foremost of myself, because this was the realization I came to sitting there at the edge of my bed this morning. To root for that, I see little difference in that than the terrorists who rooted when the towers fell on September 11th. Is our cause just? And was their cause unjust? Yes, absolutely. But bloodthirstiness is bloodthirstiness. It is neither a Christian sentiment nor an American sentiment. Astronaut Sandra Magnus joins us. We're going to talk about the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Sandra, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd. It's nice to be with you.
Sandra, I understand that you just finished speaking to a group of students at Green Park Lutheran Elementary School. How did that go?
Oh, it went great. Actually, I've been up here speaking to students most of the week, both in Belleville, where I'm from, and over here in St. Louis, and it's just a joy to come talk to kids because they have the greatest questions. They take nothing for granted, and it's just really fun to listen to all the questions they have.
What kind of questions did you get from, if you could speak up a little bit too, Sandra, what kind of questions did you get from the kids there at Green Park?
Typical questions are, what is it like to float? What is it like to be in space? What does the Earth look like? But then there's also questions that they come up with when I tell them about our spacesuits and how our spacesuits work. You know, details about, well, how do you go to the bathroom in the spacesuit, or what happens if your jetpack breaks, or what happens if you have a fire in space? What does it look like? Or what does water, you know, how do you take a shower in space? All kinds of things, like just daily living kinds of questions that they come up with. It's really fun.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that those are the kids' questions. Those are precisely the kind of questions that an adult like me has as well about that kind of experience. It's a very exclusive club, and I want to talk to you about that in just a few minutes. But first, there's the story, of course, today that something akin to the flight data recorder has been recovered from Columbia. What exactly is this piece of equipment, and what could be learned from it?
Actually, you probably have more information than I do at this point, because I've been out talking to students today, but I saw something in the paper where they had recovered a piece of recording equipment, and we'll have to see what kind of data is on this piece of equipment. But, of course, anytime we can recover some more information about what happened, it brings us closer to solving the problem and fixing it. So I'm looking forward to hearing those results as much as you do.
What was your reaction on that day when Columbia fell out of the sky?
Oh, I think the reaction that I had was pretty much similar to how all of NASA and the rest of the country looked at it, as we were surprised and shocked, because we know this is a risk. I mean, what we do is risky. We're doing exploration. That's what we do. And when you do exploration, there are things that you don't know. And you control all of the variables and control all the risks that you possibly can, but we do understand that things can happen, but you hate to see that when it actually does happen.
Is it something, I mean, you have flown, you've flown in Atlantis, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Is that kind of an event, as rare as it may be, always in the back of your mind during the course of a mission?
It's something I personally thought about before the mission, because obviously what we do is risky, and like everybody else in the office, we make the conscious decision to do what we do because it's what we've always dreamed of, and we all believe the exploration of space is important and worth the risk that we're taking.
Tell us about what being an astronaut means. I mean, most people think astronaut, a person who goes to space. What is the job of an astronaut?
Well, obviously, we do get to fly in space, and I feel very lucky that I get to do that, but most importantly, we're involved in exploration, and we happen to be the people who explore space. I think President Bush said it very well when he came to the memorial at JC about how exploration is something that is part of the human spirit. It's something that we need to do. And little do you know that everybody here in St. Louis and everybody in their daily lives are doing exploration on a smaller scale. When you pick up a book to read a new book, or when you take a new path to work that you hadn't taken before, you're actually exploring maybe on a little bit smaller scale than what we're doing at NASA. But exploration is very much part of being human, and as astronauts and engineers and scientists who work at NASA, we choose to do our exploration of the space environment.
What was your role in the Atlantis mission?
I was the what was called Mission Specialist 2. My prime duties were flight engineer, which meant that I helped Pam and Dave, the pilot and the commander, keep track of the shuttle systems and the health of the shuttle systems, from the environmental control system to the propulsion system to the communication system to the electrical system. And then while we were on orbit, I was the robotics officer, and Dr. Peggy Whitson, who was a space station crew member at the time, and I were we flew the robotic arm on station to put our piece of the truss up and attach it to the space station, and then later we flew the spacewalkers around on the end of the arm to assist them in their duties as they did their spacewalk.
So if I'm picturing you inside the working area of the space shuttle with a joystick in your hand watching video monitors while there's an astronaut perched on the end of the robotic arm, is that a pretty accurate picture?
That's a pretty accurate picture, except we were located in the laboratory module, and we were using the video monitors exclusively because we had no windows.
Tell us about the shuttle itself. People have learned a lot about the left wing of the shuttle and wheel wells and things like that in most recent times. But what is it like being on the shuttle and being in the shuttle during what can be like a 2-week mission in orbit?
You know, the shuttle is an amazing machine. When we showed up as an astronaut class in 1996, I mean, one of the first things we did was learn the shuttle. And the scientists and engineers and technicians who put the shuttle together were really, really thinking hard. It's just beautifully engineered. It's just a joy to fly on. The way they made the design and intertwined all of the systems to make it as safe as possible is just beautiful. It's a really neat piece of equipment, and it was a joy to fly on, look out the window, see the Earth float by below. It was an experience of a lifetime, actually.
Is it cramped with that many crew people?
You know, when I first was in seeing the shuttle in our full-scale mockets, I thought it was fairly small. But what you don't realize when you see it in two dimensions here on Earth is you got all that volume above your head because you can float. So it didn't seem quite so cramped when we flew in it on orbit. But I have to tell you, once we docked at the space station and opened the hatch and we flew out of the shuttle into the space station, then you realize the shuttle's quite small because the space station is absolutely huge. It was just so much fun to fly around in there. About the size of a 747. Inside of the 747.
Tell us about the space station a little bit, since you did have opportunity to visit there.
Yeah, the space station, of course, it's an international space station. One of the things that I really enjoy about the program, besides the exploration, is the fact that we have about 17 countries working together to build this laboratory in space and to work together in space on various science experiments to make life better here and to continue our exploration. So I get to work with people from all over the world, and that is just absolutely spectacular. But to go and dock to the space station and open the hatch and see your friends there on the other side, and they're living there and working there just like it's a normal work day, is truly, truly neat. And then to spend some time on the space station working in the environment that's up there and realize that we're going to have permanent presence in space with humans doing science from, we started in November of 2000, and we're going to go for the next 10 or 15 years, it's really nice to be a part of that.
Where are we at in the what phase of the construction are we at in that International Space Station?
Well, let's see. We're about about two-thirds of the way done. We have three pieces of about a 9-segment truss up, and once the truss, of course, is the backbone of the station. That's where all four solar arrays will be housed once they're on orbit. We have one solar array up there at the moment, and all of our radiators, which is our thermal conditioning or our air conditioning system, are up there. Once the truss is complete, the European science module will be launched. Once that's launched, the Japanese science module will be launched. And pretty much at that point, we can call it complete, and that'll probably take another couple of years to do.
And does that take the space shuttle to do those that construction?
Yes, we do need the space shuttle to continue to put the larger elements and larger modules up onto space station.
Is it true with regard to this, the shuttle as a vehicle? We were often told that because it was built in the era right before computer technology really started to boom, that the computers aboard, in particular the flight computers aboard the shuttle, are not as sophisticated as one might think they are compared to the kind of computers that are operating on the Earth.
Yeah, you're certainly correct. I mean, the shuttle was built and designed in the 70s and late 70s, and the first flight of the shuttle was in 1980. So, of course, the technology on the shuttle is that era, and we have more powerful computers and more advanced computers now. For example, the space station is several levels up in computer technology than the shuttle. But I look at the shuttle as just a machine that we know a lot about, and we've flown for many, many years, and we're very comfortable with, and it certainly does its job in a spectacular fashion.
Now, with regard to the crash of Columbia itself, there was some speculation immediately afterward that there was some inherent problem with the shuttle, that this is something that could happen on any flight. From your perspective, is that true?
Well, like I said, we're doing exploration, and when you're doing exploration, there are a lot of things that you don't know. I do, however, want to comment that it's very, very dangerous to speculate on what happened to Columbia. What we have to do is exactly what the Columbia Investigation Board is doing, is very slowly and painstakingly gather all the pieces of the puzzle and put it together, because we want to know and understand thoroughly what happened so we can fix it before we fly again. And it really is dangerous to speculate.
You knew and trained with some of those who perished in Columbia's fall to Earth. In particular, Willie McCool, who is the pilot, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. Laurel Clark and David Brown. Tell us a little bit about those three.
They were really wonderful people. As you mentioned, there's a group of us that started as astronauts in 1996, and those three, Willie and Dave and Laurel, were members of our class. And we all got to know each other really well while we were training. And everything that you've heard about them in the news is absolutely true. They're really brilliant people, fun to be around, and really dedicated to what they were doing.
What most people's view of astronauts and the space program in general come from things like the movies, The Right Stuff, and stuff like that. What does it take to be an astronaut, someone who does, as a job, go into space and undertake the risks as well as the exploration?
Well, you know, that's a hard question to answer, because we're all doing something that we've always dreamed of doing, and different people have arrived at the office in different paths, so I don't know if there's, you know, any given trait. You just, as kids, and a lot of us actually, as kids had this goal that we want to do exploration, we want to dream of flying in space, and we all slowly worked there through different paths. So I guess for any kid out there who's listening, I would suggest that find your dream and follow it, and just, you know, take some time. It might take some time. It might take you through paths you don't even expect. But you can achieve your dream. It just takes some time and persistence.
What was it like for you as someone who younger had thought about being an astronaut, had dreamed of doing that very thing? What was it like when you finally achieved orbit there and first stared out the portholes of the shuttle?
Well, I have to tell you what happened before I even got a chance to look at the Earth, because we're very busy when we get to orbit. Is we got to orbit, so we had main engine cutoff, which is when we're actually on orbit. We've arrived, and I felt myself floating in my seat. I had my seatbelt on still, but I felt that I was floating in my seat, and I thought, "Aha, I'm on orbit." So I took my checklist, which is sort of my instruction book, and I put it up in front of me, and I let go, and it stayed there floating, and it was just so great that I started giggling. It's like, "Look, it's floating." Pam and Jeff are like, "Yeah, you're on orbit." And it was just such a neat feeling to realize that there I was on orbit in microgravity, and things were starting to float around me. And I finally looked out the window a couple hours later after I was finished with some other duties, and the Earth is absolutely breathtaking. And I have to tell you, the first thing I noticed was how thin our atmosphere is. You know, Earth is sort of a spaceship, and we're traveling through space in our spaceship, and it's a very beautiful but very fragile planet.
And did you have a lot of time on the mission simply to stargaze or Earth gaze in that case?
Not till a little bit later. You know, we're incredibly busy on the shuttle flights because we only have a certain amount of time we're on orbit, and we have a lot to do. So our fifth day on orbit, which we call flight day 5, after we had the truss installed and the first spacewalk done, I took a little bit of time out of my bedtime, actually, so I stayed up late and spent an hour and a half, which is one revolution around the Earth, just gazing at the Earth. So I watched a day pass and a night pass and just watched the world go by, and it was really a special moment.
Now, the shuttle is orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes, and of course it's passing in and out of the night and the day side of the Earth every 90 minutes. Most of the pictures we see, of course, come from day side photographs. Uh-huh. On the night side, when the sun is obscured by this giant planet in front of you, what does the Earth look like?
You know, it's dark, and then you pass over cities, and you see the city lights, and you see the definition of cities very clear. What's really amazing is how few cities there are with respect to the whole surface area of the planet. You know, you get into the highly populated areas like the eastern seaboard of the United States, and you can see the whole coastline, but then you go over some areas like the middle of China or over in Siberia, over Russia, and it's completely, totally pitch dark. What's really spectacular, if you're passing overnight somewhere and there's a thunderstorm, you get a 1,000-mile-wide thunderstorm system with the cloud-to-cloud lightning. It's like having your own personal fireworks show.
Do you ever get, you talked about the microgravity and things floating around you and staying where you put them. Do you ever get used to that?
Yeah, you do. It takes a couple of days to adapt, but it's amazing how adaptable we are as human beings, both psychologically and physiologically. And interestingly enough, I got so used to being in space and so used to floating and what it was like to live there, that when we started to return to Earth and I started feeling gravity again, I actually felt heavy and was surprised at how that felt and wondering how I was going to readapt to being on Earth again.
Was it difficult to adapt to that?
It took a couple of days to get my balance back and get over the feeling of being heavy, but I was surprised that I had to adapt at all.
Tell me what it was like to step off the shuttle there at the landing field, to put your feet back on the Earth you've been watching from orbit.
You know, it's amazing to me. We landed and we had a few duties to do in the cockpit before we exited. One thing that was noticeable when they opened the hatch there in Florida and the surgeons and the technicians came in to help us out was, you know, you smelled Earth. You smelled the planet. Florida's sort of hot and humid and has sort of a musty smell because of the humidity. And that smell bled into the cabin. And we had been breathing, of course, circulated air for 16 days in very sterile air. And it was kind of neat to smell the planet again. So that was the first thing that I noticed. And then the second thing I noticed, you know, just the feeling of the sun and how green it looked there. And it was really kind of neat to be back. But also at the same time, it was amazing how fast the whole experience that I just had in this magical place on orbit, how fast that faded into sort of a dream.
Give us your final thoughts, with about a minute here, your final thoughts on the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy.
Well, what I'd like everybody to remember is that what we do is risky. We all accept the risks, and all of the Columbia astronauts got to live their dream. They got to go to orbit, they got to live on orbit, and they got to do everything they've always dreamed of doing. And while I'm sad, because you know we all miss our friends, I'm very happy that they got to achieve their dream, and I want people to remember that and be happy for them. I also want to thank everyone in the area for the condolences and the thoughts and the prayers that we got. It was very, very touching, and it really helped everybody at NASA to receive those good wishes. So thank you all very much for that.
Sandra, are you going to be speaking anywhere tonight or tomorrow?
Actually, I'm headed back to Houston tonight. I've been here since Monday, sort of talking with different schools and different groups, and it's time for me to return back to Houston.
And are you going to fly again?
I certainly hope so. I'm waiting with eagerness for my next flight and hoping that at some point in my career I can live on the space station.
Do you know when the shuttle's going to fly again?
Nope, I do not. We'll have to leave that up to the Columbia Accident Investigation Board to identify what happened so we can fix it and then return to flight.
Sandra Magnus, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
And thank you, Todd. Bye-bye.
Astronaut Sandra Magnus, we've been talking about the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy and life as an astronaut. When we come back from this break, we're going to continue this hour with Amy White. She has written a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I hope that some of you read it. I'd like you to invite, of course, your questions and comments as well. I first became acquainted, not personally, but via back channels, Rodney Stortz, sometime before Jack Buck died. And I was very curious at the first anniversary of September 11th, how he would comport himself, what he would say on the anniversary of that tragedy at a gathering, a multi-faith gathering, in Forest Park. I will tell you before we start talking about this in the next, right after this break, I was not disappointed with what Rodney Stortz had to say. And then when I heard him at the memorial for Jack Buck and then the funeral for Jack Buck, still not disappointed. He passed away very recently. We will talk about his life and his legacy with Amy White when we come back after this break. And then we'll round off this first hour of Issues, Etc., talking with Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life about what's been going on in the Illinois House and Senate.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When should a Christian confess his sins to another Christian? When should a Christian confess his sins to his pastor? When, if ever, should a Christian confess his sins to the whole congregation? You'll find answers to these questions and more in the new Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book, and you can even read an excerpt. issuesetc.org. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear a powerful way to help young children understand God's great gift of love and teach them about missions at the same time. Tell them real-life stories. A missionary with Evangelical Bible Mission International traveled to the country of Papua New Guinea and attended a welcoming ceremony. A tribal woman was so glad to see her that the lady offered the missionary her purse or bilum. Women in Papua New Guinea carry everything in their bilum, groceries, money, and it was the woman's only bilum. She sacrificed a prized possession and reminded the missionary how God sacrificed Jesus Christ. This story is on worldwidekidsclub.com, a website of music and stories to inspire children to share Christ. Pray for more youth to commit themselves to life in missions. Help kids learn about missions by logging on to worldwidekidsclub.com or call 1-800-804-9524. That's 800-804-9524.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Jesus predicted wars and rumors of war. The rumors have passed. The battle has been joined. The Bible tells about numerous wars, and often it was the superior force that was defeated. Gideon, for one example, led a ragtag group of 300 against a stronger Midianite force. And weaker Gideon won. After the war stories are told, the Bible's moral is clear. Prepare for war as you will. It is ultimately God who gives or withholds victory. As President Lincoln said, the Almighty has His own purposes. We are stronger than Iraq, that we know. But let us not forget that we are weaker than God. We have not pleased Him in all our ways as a nation. Pray for victory? Yes. But no matter how much we may be convinced of the rightness of our cause, our prayers must still be the humble prayers of sinners. That the conflict will end quickly? That the consequences of war will be beneficial for peace in the Middle East and the world? That innocent lives will be spared? For all this we pray, Lord, have mercy.
The heavens are telling, and Sing for Joy invites you to listen.
Sunday at noon on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're joined for a few minutes here by Amy White. She's a corporate and political speechwriter. She's author of a monthly column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Today's column is titled At One with the Shepherd, and she's joining us from Oakville to talk about Rodney Stortz. Amy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd, very much.
Who was Rodney Stortz?
Well, Rodney Stortz, the short answer is that Rodney Stortz was my pastor. The long answer is that he was pastor of Twin Oaks Presbyterian Church, and he also had a radio ministry, Oaks of Righteousness, that was on Monday through Friday for over 8 years. And it originated in St. Louis on the Bot Radio Network and eventually grew to several other Midwestern states.
And I know that's the longer answer, but I'm sure there's more to it here. I remember Rodney Stortz coming to my mind at the first anniversary of September 11th, when, and this may have been before or after, when Jack Buck passed away. I can't remember how those events came down, but I remember I was waiting with bated breath to see what this pastor would say. I'd heard good things at the end of an interfaith event, whether you get the gospel out and talk about Jesus Christ, and I wasn't disappointed. He did. Was this typical?
It was very typical. Rodney was extremely focused on the gospel and very interested in the integrity of the Word of God. And much of his teaching came against interfaith movements and things that essentially watered down the essence of the gospel. And I think that was one reason why his teaching was, you know, growing in renown every year, and why the radio ministry was growing, why church membership grew. He actually began at a church in St. Louis that they outgrew, and he began 20 Twin Oaks at that point, and it started to meet in a school, and it grew and grew, and then actually spun off another sister church just last year. And I think that that's a real reflection that people could recognize that his teaching was deeply rooted in the Word of God and not simply what was popular or what was easy to swallow.
Tell us about his illness and what effect, if any, in your mind, that had on the last years of his life.
Well, I remember that my husband and I had not been members of the church very long when we were sitting in a Sunday morning service, and Rodney, in a very calm and dignified and compassionate way, shared with the congregation that he had just received a diagnosis of liver cancer. And I think that some people in the sanctuary had probably already received that news, but the majority of us had not. And I remember sitting there with the tears just flooding down my face, thinking, my goodness, he's going to die. Everyone dies of liver cancer. And that began a long process of watching Rodney being very willing to not only ask for God's very best in that scenario, but being willing to fight, being willing to undergo a variety of different treatments with the idea that any extension of his life that God provided, he was going to put to good use. And you could see a change in his preaching, which he had actually commented a few times that others had commented to him that they sensed a different urgency when he preached, and he disagreed with that a little bit. He had hoped, I think, that the urgency had always been present. But I think that what people were responding to is that when a sermon is willing to hold out the hope of Christ to you, then that is a gift in itself. But when a minister stands before you who is in a battle for their very mortal life, fighting cancer, and holds out Christ to you, I think that that is a poignancy and a sensitivity that just touches you very deep in your heart. And it goes back to that phrase that preachers are fond of referring to, preaching Christ as a dying man to other dying men. And so Rodney actually had an opportunity to live that for 3.5 years.
And it was 3.5 years after the diagnosis. That's longer than most last with that kind of cancer, am I right?
It really was. In fact, there were several points during the treatment where the liver appeared fine, and there would be a hiatus of sorts where he would enjoy relative good health before the next tumor would appear. So it was a real growth in faith as you prayed, not knowing exactly what God's intentions would be, knowing that there were certain times when there was a reprieve, and then, you know, within several months, another tumor would appear and be treated.
Now, since you remember there at Twin Oaks, can you give us any indication about how his family has coped with this passing?
Well, I don't know personally how his family is coping, except to say that during the funeral, they really were exceptional. I have never attended a funeral where a family gave such a powerful testimony of God's goodness in their life. Because usually during a funeral, I think everyone's very conscious that that's an extremely intense time for the family. Frequently, the family doesn't take part in any of the actual mechanisms of the funeral because they're grieving. And this was different because Rodney's three daughters, who were all very gifted musically, actually sung several songs through their father's funeral service. And they also read some wonderful reflections on what it was like to have him as a father. And it was amazing because there was so much love and joy and pride in their reflections on him. And there was no overt signs of grief, though of course you knew that their hearts were broken to have lost him. And it was a powerful testimony. We had TV cameras, a couple of local TV stations had station cameras up in the balcony. And I thought, wow, you know, for people who watch this, certainly they're going to wonder, how is it this family has so much hope and confidence in where their loved one is and their opportunity to be reunited with them, that they can stand here before us and even sing, you know, with a full and beautiful voice. So it was really an incredible testimony that I can only imagine Rodney would have been thrilled about.
Perhaps the most public, most viewed opportunity that Pastor Storch had to proclaim Jesus Christ and our hope in him and him alone was at the memorial and the funeral for Jack Buck, who passed away recently. Tell us about that.
Well, the death of Jack Buck really plunged St. Louis into mourning, and the city really reacted strongly to the loss of this beloved broadcaster. And Rodney actually was in a position as a personal friend of Jack Buck's and of his wife Carol to have been an unofficial pastor to Jack. And Twin Oaks was made available for the funeral service, and Rodney also played a role in attending another memorial service at Busch Stadium where he offered a very Christ-centered prayer. So during the context of Jack Buck's funeral, which was broadcast on KMOX to hundreds of thousands of listeners, Rodney presented the gospel not once, not twice, but several times, using different analogies, using clear and concise language. And as you looked out into the congregation and you saw famous athletes and media personalities and people who are pillars of the St. Louis community, you couldn't help but rejoice that God had established a very special opportunity for Rodney to bring glory to himself through that funeral. And it was also a way that many people were introduced for the very first time to Rodney Stewart.
You know, I was amazed because an opportunity like that comes along once in a lifetime. And the temptation on the part of a pastor who's given that kind of very public forum. In this case, my in-laws watched the funeral in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I mean, this was a national event viewed by many.
Absolutely.
And watched by many. Jack Buck was a giant. There's no two ways about it. But the temptation, I know that from my own personal experience, would be to either eulogize Jack and spend all your time doing that, or to water down this message so that everyone watching, there'd be no one getting offended, and you wouldn't put an edge on this event of the passing of someone like Jack Buck. But that is not what Pastor Stortz did. He was plain, as you said, plain and simple.
He really was very determined that this opportunity would be used to hold out the gospel of Christ. And he even made a comment, which I referred to in the column, where he told the entire sanctuary, just 5 minutes into the funeral service, "We will celebrate Jack's life, but we are here to meet Jesus." And he emphasized that point through the entire funeral. And actually, I happen to know that a very distinguished Cardinal ball player and a future Hall of Famer, as he was leaving that service, turned to one of our elders and said, "How I long to have a funeral just like this." And I think that he was responding to the incredible hope that was offered in that funeral service of what Christ has done for man.
I spoke recently with Jim Talent, Senator Jim Talent, and he talked briefly about his relationship with his pastor, Pastor Stortz, and how Pastor Stortz had helped him, especially after losing an election and in deeper Bible study. Was that part also of what Pastor Stortz was about with his people?
It sure was. And, you know, it's interesting that God chose to use Rodney in a lot of very significant ways. You have, like you said, the national forum he was given through the Jack Buck funeral, but he also was in a position to shepherd and minister to several people who are currently serving in Congress, Representative Todd Akin, Senator Talent. So there was some wonderful opportunities that God put Rodney to such excellent use. And so it's exciting to see how one man's dedication, sold out dedication of the gospel of Christ, ended up blessing a lot of different people, including people who are in influential positions today and have benefited from his teaching.
Final question, Amy. What will be the legacy of Pastor Rodney Stortz?
I think the legacy of Rodney Stortz will be that he was sold out to the singular purpose of life of spreading the good news of the gospel. And it is exciting to know that through modern technology, that the God who foresees the future made arrangements that all of Rodney's teaching would be recorded in such a way as to be preserved. And they will continue to be heard on the Oaks of Righteousness program, which he founded. And there's 18 years of sermons that the rest of us will get to enjoy, even though Rodney is already enjoying the presence of Christ, that we will continue to benefit from that teaching long into the future.
Amy White, thank you very much for being our guest. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Todd, very much.
Amy White is a corporate and political speechwriter. She also writes a monthly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Today's column is titled "At One with the Shepherd." It deals with the legacy of Pastor Rodney Stortz, and she joins us from Oakville. Folks, if you'd like to read that article for yourself or any of Amy White's articles, you can go to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch website. It's stltoday.com, stltoday.com. We're going to spend some time now talking with Bill Beckman, Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. There was some abortion legislation in the Illinois House and Senate, some up, some down. We'll find out what the news is Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Bill, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Bill, tell us what happened there in the Illinois legislature.
Well, it seems that we have a situation where with the Democrats in control, that there's an anti-life flavor that is going through the legislature, which is kind of what we expected after the last election. What we have a situation right now is like the Choose Life license plate bill was stymied in committee in both the House and the Senate, and it's focused on promoting adoption, but the Democrats labeled it as controversial.
And another bill dealing with, which was intended to be a parallel of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act at the national level, was also considered. What happened with that one in Illinois?
Well, Jill Stanek went down there on March 12th to testify for that bill and pointed out that it had passed in the U.S. Senate by 98-0. And I believe that Senator O'Malley had last year made that same comment, though I don't know if he made it directly to the committee. But the fact of the matter is that it was not let out of the committee, so there was at least, I don't have an actual vote count on that, but at least a majority or an even number of people refused to vote in favor of letting that out of committee. So that's a pretty amazing event that we've got a more radical view of that issue than at the national level, where we've got people like Senator Kennedy, who's like certainly not a friend of life, who were willing to vote for that bill at the national level.
I want to come back to each of these bills in detail, but there was one other that did make it through the committee, passed by 8-5. What was this bill?
Well, this was a bill that basically is supposed to be modeled after what's called the FACE law, which is called Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, and they're attempting to bring this down to the state level to basically attempt to say that if anyone interferes with or intimidates someone coming to an abortion clinic, they describe it as a reproductive health services facility, that they will be, you know, able to be charged with a crime, and effectively that people could be able to bring suit against them for damages for this intimidation or interference.
Okay, so then let's take these in detail, going back in kind of the reverse direction with regard to this access bill. Does it involve, the paper says it would be a misdemeanor to interfere with a woman entering the clinic. What exactly is interfering? How is that defined by this bill?
In the bill it's defined as the following. It says interfere with means to restrict a person's freedom of movement. Now, the real challenge on something like that, and intimidate is defined as means to place a person in a reasonable apprehension of bodily harm to herself or himself or another. Now, the problem with these words is that they're very vague in what this means, and effectively, since we already know that the people who support abortion have claimed that people standing in front of an abortion clinic praying are effectively intimidating people, that their interpretation of these words and the possibility of a judge interpreting these words in a similar fashion could be very dangerous to freedom of speech.
Okay, so in other words, there's a subjectivity in the bill that the committee did pass that concerns you here. Could, when it says they could sue beyond a misdemeanor charge, does that mean they could ask for civil damages?
Yes. Yeah. They're basically identifying that the plaintiffs could ask for damages and court costs and that kind of thing. So effectively, it seems what they're trying to do is it accomplished something which was failed to happen with the Nell versus Shiloh ruling that they couldn't deal with these massive damages against people for basically, freedom of speech issues. And now they're coming up with another strategy to try to accomplish the same type of a mission, it would seem.
In your mind, Bill, if this were some other type of protest outside some other type of organization, would this kind of bill be allowed to pass out of the Illinois Senate Committee?
Very unlikely, because as you can see, I mean, the bill is focused on reproductive health services. So effectively, if somebody wants to protest in front of a fur coat store, nobody's going to be intimidated by, or you know, that intimidation for people entering that store, that's not a problem. You know, it's like, you know, They don't need to be protected, whereas people entering reproductive health services facilities do, in their mind.
The other bill that did not make it out of committee that would have declared a fetus with a beating heart and muscle movement born alive, do you have any idea why that did not make it out of committee? It seems a beating heart and muscle movement would qualify a baby under any other circumstances to be called alive.
Well, I can't really speculate on what was going through the mind of these legislators, but obviously based on the testimony that Jill Stanek gave them, they were certainly very well informed on the fact that this is language that had already been fully accepted, you know, by unanimous vote in the U.S. Senate, and that the wording was identical to that. I suppose that maybe you could say, well, they were able to hide behind the fact that, well, so it's already federal law, why do we need to do anything here? But obviously that was the exact opposite of their logic regarding what the bill we were just talking about, where there's a federal bill at that level, and they decided they wanted to put one at the state level, too. So no matter how you look at it, it's a rather indefensible position in terms of the people who basically, you know, voted against allowing that out of committee.
The one that kind of puzzles me, and we've talked about it before here on Issues, Etc., was the bill you mentioned first having to do with the Choose Life plates that was knocked down in committee as well. What are Choose Life plates in the state of Illinois? What would they have been?
Well, we've got a large number of specialty plates in Illinois, and each specialty plate has an extra fee above the standard license plate annual fee. And effectively, in the case of this plate, the additional dollars would be tended to go for organizations that promote and support adoption and to help women who are, you know, making decisions to put their children up for adoption because of their circumstances. And effectively, the committee, opposed allowing that bill to come to a vote of the actual House and Senate, that they basically stopped those bills in committee. The Choose Life license plate has already been established and is actually for sale in six states. In two other states, it's been now approved, though in one of those states it's currently under legal challenge. But in all the other six where it's already actively being sold, that those legal challenges have all fallen by the wayside because the courts have ruled that they don't have any merit. So in reality, you know, the argument that this is something that is not a legitimate opportunity to promote adoption is not based on fact, because in all the cases where there's been any kind of legal challenges, they've been thrown out.
So this would have been a specialty plate like all other specialty plates, and it would have had the same fee that would have gone to not to anti-abortion or to pro-life groups. It would have gone to promote adoption.
Promote adoption, yes. I mean, it would, right. It would have done nothing to further the pro-life cause or anything like that. I mean, the money was directed to promoting adoption.
Okay, let's come back to the one that did make it out of committee, because the other ones obviously, or at least for the time being, don't seem to be going anyplace. What needs to happen with this bill that would make it a misdemeanor for someone to interfere with a woman or someone else entering an abortion clinic?
Well, certainly, people need to, let their, representatives know how they feel on this bill and whether or not they think it's appropriate to have such kind of regulation, certainly from the standpoint of people, who are pro-life and who recognize the value of prayer and sidewalk counseling in front of abortion clinics, that this is a very dangerous bill, and certainly they would be strongly opposed to it because they feel that it would deny them their free speech rights because of the subjective interpretation of the language that is very possible and certainly easily subject to abuse based on other cases that we've seen in other states where there have been similar types of legislation, invoked to deal with, people out in front of abortion clinics.
I'm thinking about the Granite City Hope Clinic over there on my side of the river. I'm a resident of Illinois.
Right.
And I'm thinking about the regular protests that take place all around that clinic and nearby. How would that picture change if this bill voted by committee were to become law?
Well, the situation would be that if someone approaching that clinic wanted to bring a case, that all they'd need to do under this bill is claim that they'd been intimidated or they'd been interfered with, and then it'd be a matter of going into court and attempting to determine whether or not that was actually what had happened. And so, obviously, the people that were out there who were attempting to pray or sidewalk counsel would definitely want to make sure that they had plenty of witnesses, so that they basically certainly didn't want to be out there by themselves, because effectively there'd be no, a means to defend themselves. But if they do, then effectively the point is they're still going to be subjected to this harassment of being brought into court if they're accused of these kind of things and probably unfairly. But that's then got to be determined in the court.
Do you think that's the real intent of this bill, is to intimidate via the courts those who would protest in front of abortion clinics?
Well, I think you can only interpret it that way because there's no real recent activities that have in any way suggested that there's been any kind of abuses that have resulted in people having serious difficulties with entering clinics, or and so effectively the need for such a law would seem to be suggesting that just the fact that people are out there is obviously deemed to be a problem, and they're trying to intimidate those people and make them go away.
Finally, with only about a minute here, the other two bills, are they dead and gone, or is there any chance?
Well, there's always hope, but effectively, even if they can't be resurrected this year, they'll be back again next year. I mean, the mechanisms of the legislature, there's always a loophole where you can make something happen. But I mean, I think that in this case, the challenge is going to be that with the current mindset of the leadership, it will be extremely difficult to get any of those loopholes to apply. So effectively, it's probably likely that it won't happen until next year. But then certainly those bills will be backed again, we'll have to see whether or not by that time we've done anything to change the minds of the legislators to give them a better shot, and at least get them out of committee so they can be fairly considered by the entire body.
Bill Beckman, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Okay, Todd, thank you very much.
Bill Beckman is Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. Illinois Right to Life's website is illinoisrighttolife.org. It's all one word, illinoisrighttolife.org. You can also call them at area code 312-422-9300. Coming up after this break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Larry Rast about pietism. He's Assistant Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And then in the third hour, Dr. Jack Preuss joins us. We'll talk about ministry to soldiers. He served as a military chaplain during the First Gulf War with some Marines, and this is a timely conversation for us to revisit. He's also president of Concordia University in Irvine, California. We'll find out what Dr. Jack Preuss has to say about the place of military chaplains on the battlefield. Just a reminder, pietism comes up next, and then we'll also be talking about ministry to soldiers. If you have someone who's in the military, you'll want to listen to that third hour because this pertains to them directly. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.